Show with live musicians and fusion belly dance from Bridgetown Review. That's Thursday, August 21st at the Star Theater. For more information, go to the right side of the KBOO webpage under events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, coming to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolution, the force that works underground even long before it bursts forth. Was it Snowpiercer or the Max derailment that made me think of French theorist Daniel Ben Said's 2001 essay on The Mole and the Locomotive, in which the locomotive stands, of course, for the powers of capitalism? He writes there that, quote, "The train of progress has been derailed, but just as the reed outlives the oak, so the mole prevails over the locomotive. Our old friend is still digging away. After 30 years of liberal counter-reform and restoration, the market-based order now seems inescapable. The eternal present no longer appears to have any future, and absolute capitalism no longer any outside. And yet, a radical critique of the existing order braces itself against the tide, inspired by new ways of thinking, resistance, and events. Capital seems to have become the permanent horizon for the rest of time, but in fact, there is always conflict and contradiction. There is always discontent in the midst of civilization and crisis in the midst of culture. There are always those who refuse servitude and resist injustice. The old mole burrows on." End quote. Today's show is about that conflict and contradiction, about oppression and opposition, and more particularly about state violence and resistance to it in Honduras and Ferguson and Palestine. We'll be talking about law and order, trust and violence, struggle and solidarity, and about some of the ways we can nourish each other, both physically and figuratively. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab. Those audio posts generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also friend or follow us on Facebook or Twitter to find out when the week's show is posted online. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com if you have questions or comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. Contact us if you're doing activism, planning events, engaging in movement that our other listeners will want to know about. We'd love to hear from you. Later on today's show, I'll share some left commentary on recent events in Missouri. Our movie moles, Jan Hocken and Joe Clement, will be talking about the 2013 film Omar, written and directed by Palestinian Hani Abu Assad, about life on both sides of the occupation wall. And Jan will be back at the end of the hour to talk with Robert Adams and Chris Soebroto of Sisters of the Road Cafe about their work serving immediate needs and seeking systemic change. But first today, Bill Resnick talks with historian Dana Frank about why so many children are fleeing Honduras. Frank teaches at the University of California at Santa Cruz and has published a number of books on labor history, Latin America, and economic nationalism, as well as many articles in journals including The Nation, Politico, The Baffler, and Foreign Affairs.
Dana Frank, welcome to KABU.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dana Frank teaches history. She specializes in Honduras. She's written on the current refugee crisis, desperate children flooding into the United States, most apprehended at the border and put in detention, most from Honduras. So, Dana Frank, what's happening in your view?
Well, you know, the media is acting like this is a sudden crisis that they discovered, but this is a long arc of Honduran history and U.S. domination of Honduras that's producing this crisis. I think people know that Honduras has long been known as sort of a captive nation of the United States, as one important book calls it, and was the site of banana exports for decades and decades. Honduras was the base for the invasion of Guatemala in 1954 when the U.S. overthrew a democratically elected president. It was the base for the Contra War. Palmarolo Air Force Base, now called Sotocano Air Force Base, was the base for the U.S. to invade and attack the Sandinista government in Nicaragua during the 80s. So there's never been sort of a golden age in Honduras when it wasn't under the U.S. thumb. And that means, in turn, that Honduras has been dominated by these 13 oligarchic families that have a lockdown on Honduras, or have had a lockdown on the Honduran economy and on its political system for decades and decades.
That ended, though, fairly recently, didn't it? They actually had a free election, and a real reformer was elected. Is that?
Well, in 2006, Manuel Zelaya was elected president, and he came out of one of the mainstream parties, these two parties that trade off power behind the scenes. And he himself came from one of these backgrounds, but he then drifted to the center, shall we say. Now, I wouldn't say he went all the way to the left, but as democratically elected left and center-left governments came to power with democratization in the rest of Latin America over the course of the 90s and the 2000s. You know, he started working with these governments, and he did some things that the ruling elites didn't like. He stopped privatization of the ports. He stopped some illegal blogging. He stopped privatization of things that they wanted, like of the electrical company. And he very famously raised the minimum wage by 50%, although that didn't apply in the maquiladora sector, the export processing sector. And the elites didn't like that, and so they used a pretext, a totally bogus pretext, to overthrow him in a military coup of 5 years ago on June 28, 2009, famously putting him on his pajamas on a plane that stopped at the U.S. Air Force Base, which means there is U.S. complicity there, and flew him to Costa Rica. And that military coup of 2009 has just thrown open the doors for this spectacular crisis of criminality. Of course, the coup itself was a criminal act that has never been addressed. There was a bogus election in its aftermath. It was allowed to stabilize in the United States, and we can come back to U.S. policy. But there was an illegitimate election that followed it by a few months, and two successive presidents that came in through fraudulent elections and illegitimate elections that have just thrown out the rule of law, and the spectacular corruption is what opened the door to the kind of violence that the kids are fleeing.
Right. Let's talk about that, the spectacular corruption and how it occurred and how the police forces and militaries became so degraded. The U.S. cooperated in the coup. In fact, generally, they don't do coups unless they check with the U.S. embassy. And the military is so dependent on the U.S. for money and equipment and stuff. Why did the U.S. allow it to happen? What did they have against Zelaya?
Well, I think that's, of course, the $65,000 question. Why did the U.S. treat the immediate coup dictator, post-coup dictator Roberto Micheletti, as an equal player to Zelaya? Why did they announce they were going to recognize the outcome of the post-coup election even before the polls had closed? We don't really exactly know. It's clearly Zelaya was the weakest link in the chain, or the weakest domino of all these progressive governments that had come to power in the U.S. was sending a message to the governments of Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua,
Venezuela,
that it was not, that it would do it to somebody else. And of course, the U.S. had tried in 2002 in Venezuela. And so it was obviously a pushback against the democratization and the achievement of social justice and more equality in Latin America.
And the challenge to U.S. economic dominance.
Yeah, absolutely. And also militarily. I mean, Ecuador closed the U.S. military base when Correa came to power in Ecuador. So the U.S. is like Soto Cano Air Force Base at Palmarola in Honduras is very important. It's one of the only places they can land the big planes between the United States and Colombia, and the other one is Guantanamo Bay, of course. It's also about U.S. sending a message that it will continue to flex its military power. In fact, the U.S. has increased its military presence in Latin America, and especially in Central America, and especially in Honduras since the coup. So it's also about U.S. military presence, and it's also about economic power. It's about saying we're going to protect what are defined as economic interests, which means U.S. elite corporate investments, and also there's mining companies and dam companies. You know, this sort of keeping in place this economic system that exploits working people and destroys the environment and extracts wealth from these countries. And, you know, the U.S. is perfectly willing and, in fact, increasingly recently to use its military power to protect those corporate interests.
And also, it was a time when Chavez was sort of insulting the United States and tweaking up things about their manhood. It seems to me that may have contributed, although Hillary Clinton was the great supporter of U.S. policy. She was macho than anybody.
One of the things that happened is the coup, the Honduran coup, threw people off guard because Obama had only been in office for several months. And you know, and everybody was goo-goo-dada about Hillary Clinton and about Obama. And I remember people just couldn't believe they'd do it. You know, surely they don't know. Or they both ignored the actual message from the U.S. ambassador in Honduras, who said this is a unconstitutional coup and completely wrong. And, you know, we know that from the WikiLeaks now, and they just blew that off because they want to extend U.S. domination and protect U.S. domination in the region, both militarily and economically. And it's very, very disturbing and shocking. And that coup itself and the post-coup regimes that have been in power since just opened the door for criminality. So again, you know, the current president, we can get to him, you know, he himself was a major backer of the coup. There was certainly corruption and drug trafficking and gangs present in Honduras and certain levels of pieces of the government here and there before the coup. Everyone knows that. But the coup just threw open the door because they just threw the criminal justice system out. The corruption just flourished among the judiciary so that the judiciary, much of it is corrupt. And, you know, this is all established by Human Rights Watch and UN and many groups. It's not like just me asserting this here. It's widely documented. The police in particular are spectacularly corrupt.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Dana Frank, who's a historian, and she specializes in Honduras. We've just discussed the background of the crisis on the border as Honduran children, mostly Honduran children, have been flooding into the United States, desperate for asylum and safety. We've been talking about the history of Honduras that led to this. Dana Frank, you were talking about the degradation of the police, the judiciary. What happened after the coup that led to this enormous level of criminality and murder in Honduras?
Well, the top level officials, and I mean up to the very top of the post-coup regime, are themselves allegedly linked, many of them, to organized crime, to gangs, and to drug traffickers. So they then countenance prosecutors, judges, and police that themselves are interlaced with all these criminal elements. Most famously, Juan Carlos Bonilla, the national chief of police, who was brought in 2 years ago to supposedly clean up the police, and he himself was then revealed to have participated in death squad killings between 1998 and 2002. So this kind of the criminals running the show is what we have been going on there. First of all, if you don't have a functioning police, and the government itself has estimated an official that 70% of the police are corrupt and beyond saving. That's 70%, and I would certainly say it's actually probably even higher than that now. That was last fall. Which means that most people, you can kill anybody you want, do anything you want, and nothing will happen to you. The police don't even show up at crimes. They don't investigate even major cases with international attention. At least 36 journalists have been killed. Lawyers are killed. Trade unionists have been killed. Human rights defenders have been killed. Another journalist was just killed today. When we think about the kids and people say they're fleeing gangs and violence, absolutely. They're fleeing out-of-control gangs and violence. And those gangs themselves are proliferating and interlocked with government officials. Of course, I think people know that a lot of these gangs have their origins in the United States, and particularly in Los Angeles and the U.S. because of its racist criminal justice system, throws these kids into jail where they become ever more hardened criminals and they learn how to operate at a more dangerous level, and then the U.S. deports them, particularly to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where those same gangs then spread even more forcefully. and without a functioning criminal justice system and a government that's actively countenancing that. It's not like the government is weak in the face of these criminals. The government is itself interlocked with these communities.
Part of that, though, I suspect, is that there were large popular movements in Honduras. Zelaya had a lot of support. The reforms he did had a lot of support. And ordinary folks in Honduras began seeing that they might have a future and that they could organize their own political party in opposition to the two semi-official parties.
Well, actually, the cause and effect is a little more complicated than that. Zelaya was not a heroic figure to the social movements in the left. I mean, he was seen as being as part of the political machine who had done a few progressive things. But even that was a threat to these oligarchs and to the U.S. So in response to the coup, this huge social movement called the National Front of Popular Resistance came together, sort of our fantasy social movement, included the labor movement, the small farmers, the women's movement, the indigenous movement, the Afro-Indigenous people's movement, human rights defenders, the LGBT movement, all of that. And also much of the traditional ruling party, the liberal party, the so-called liberals in resistance. Now, those people were not all, quote, Zelaya supporters, as the U.S. media depicted them. These are people rising up to support constitutional order, which is a fragile thing in Latin America, thanks in part to U.S. support for dictatorships and the military. So it was really about supporting constitutional order, not so much as Zelaya as the heroic figure. And out of that grew this massive movement. You know, as many as a million people, according to the right-wing newspapers and TV, came to greet Zelaya at the airport when he finally was allowed to return in 2011. And there's only 8 million people in the country. It will give you a sense of the scale. But again, Zelaya was a symbol of constitutional order. And then out of that movement, to try to get Zelaya restored and stop the coup, out of that came this vast social movement called the Resistance, which eventually decided to go into electoral politics. So in 2012, for the first time in Honduran history, that came together as an opposition party called Libre, L-I-B-R-E, which means freedom or free in Spanish. And Libre, the Zelaya's wife, ran for president. Her name is Xiomara Castro de Zelaya. And she was ahead in the polls almost all of 2012 and may or may not have actually won the election. We don't really know. But the person who came to power at this presidential election this last November, who came into office in this January, is named Juan Orlando Hernandez, and he is a very dangerous guy. He himself was ahead of a key committee in the Honduran Congress that supported the coup illegally. He was the one, he was president of Congress in December 2012, led something called the technical coup, which you didn't hear about. But at 3 in the morning, he led the overthrow of four members of the Honduran Supreme Court, the constitutional, almost all the constitutional branch of the Supreme Court, and they named their replacements completely illegally the next day. This is a man who is currently the president.
Dana Frank, let me suggest that part of the reason that the military and police are now so degraded was that the oligarchy, instead of having them actually fight real criminals or the criminal gangs or the drug gangs, their mission became to put down the resistance movement.
Well, it's certainly, there's a tremendous amount of overt repression of the resistance after the coup, but also these killings of journalists and of judges are still going on. I think it's really also important to underscore that it's not like Juan Orlando Hernandez, the president, is this heroic figure fighting the drug war and defending the little children. He himself has this tremendous track record of countenancing violence, tremendous track record of his own criminal acts that are in impunity, and he himself is, of course, ahead of these armed forces and police and his new military police that very deliberately beat up and arrested the leading upstanding advocate for children in the country, Jose Guadalupe Ruelas. And then Juan Orlando Hernandez, horrifically, because of this crisis with the children, is suddenly welcome at the White House and being promoted as a heroic figure fighting the good fight against the drug traffickers, all the way up to an interview in Time magazine, which is just stunning, that he could be celebrated as a heroic figure when he himself is the leader of a repressive and dangerous government the U.S. is backing to the hilt.
This is KBU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Dana Frank, who's a historian, especially writes now on modern Honduras, and has written on the reasons that so many children are fleeing. Tell us briefly, why are these gangs, though, killing so many children? There are executions of children all over Honduras.
Well, it's whole families. These are messages that if you don't join the gang or once in you don't do what the gang says, we will kill you and your family. And, you know, they're learning this kind of behavior from the government. There's a long history in Latin America and Honduras of family members being killed to get to their parents as a threat to their parents. So it's a threat to everybody else that if you don't do what the gang members say. But I want to underscore that the gang members are able to do this because there's no functioning criminal justice system, because the U.S. is pretending that this government is somehow functioning to be able to handle the gangs, and that the government at the top level, which is countenancing and interlacing these gangs, isn't the problem. But it's really important to not say it's just these bad little guys down the ground doing this stuff. It's really being countenanced and managed and in some ways encouraged by folks at the top of the government, and they actually in some ways are getting rewarded for their countenancing and putting up with this and allowing it, because of course then that they can then justify new money in the name of fighting drug trafficking.
What about U.S. policy and how movements can change it?
Well, you know, the U.S. has continued to pour money into the Honduran post-coup regime. In fact, after a brief drop in 2009, right after the coup, U.S. military spending for Honduras has increased. It's around $25 million a year, but I do want to underscore that we don't even know how much it is, because there isn't transparency about the Defense spending bill. So the State Department and the White House have been extremely supportive, even celebrating the post-coup governments. And as I said before, the Juan Orlando Hernandez, the current president, with a vast criminal history, is now welcome at the White House as a heroic figure protecting the kids. What's interesting, and I think what people don't know about, is there's something called the Honduras Solidarity Network, which includes folks in Oregon and in Washington State, that has been extremely active since day one of the coup, and includes faith-based people, includes labor people, human rights people, Latin American solidarity people, the peace community, all kinds of people, that has been doing amazing work, bringing people up from Honduras, taking delegations down there, and educating people at the grassroots, but also pressuring Congress. And I think people may not know that 108 members of Congress in the House signed a letter on May 28th to Secretary of State Kerry questioning the elections, questioning militarization by the Honduran government, questioning the U.S. support for the Honduran police and military because of human rights abuses by U.S.-funded security forces. And that was in the New York Times. And I also want to say there's been a lot of pressure from the Senate as well, and I particularly want to celebrate Senator Jeff Merkley, who has really been fantastic on this issue in Honduras. And Ron Wyden has also signed a letter last summer questioning police and military aid to Honduras. So I have to say, I never was a person who thought, call your congressperson. And since the coup, I've really learned a tremendous amount. And I can say these folks are listening, and they want to hear from constituents. So please call your congressmember, whoever they are, and say, you know, cut police and military aid to Honduras and stop acting like Juan Orlando Hernandez is a heroic figure fighting the good fight, that he is part of the problem, and that we need to distance ourselves from this government and stop funding them, even to try to clean things up. About $300 million in U.S. money and European money has gone into supposedly helping clean up the Honduran police in the last 2.5 years with absolutely no effect, or essentially no effect. We shouldn't be pouring even more money in there. They're getting rewarded for not cleaning themselves up. So I do want to underscore that I think that's this individual calling your Congress member. Don't be afraid. Just say, please don't support the Honduran government with more military aid. That's all you have to say. And don't be afraid to call.
In addition, though, it seems to me there are probably many Honduras's to come as the U.S. power sort of wanes in the world, but their military power is absolutely dominant, and you're using it more and more. It seems to me we really need a peace and justice movement that will maintain the pressure.
Well, we have a peace and justice movement that doesn't get reported on, that does amazingly wonderful work. It's just not big and powerful enough in the way we'd like it seen. And, you know, so some of it is there are local peace and justice movements in Oregon and Washington, your listeners, you know, that we can join in with and keep building that. And then figure out how you take that movement and build power from it. I think you're absolutely right about this. Is, you know, the U.S. is like this flailing beast. And this whole thing with the crisis of the children has been a pretext to, you know, get deeper in bed with scary governments in Central America, not just Honduras, but with Perez Molina in Guatemala. The president of Guatemala has, you know, has a long history of supporting genocidal policies in Guatemala during the 80s. It's very terrifying that he's president. And the U.S. Marines are now working closely with the Guatemalan military, although we supposedly haven't been working with them since 1977. You know, just two things though to pay attention to in terms of hope. One is El Salvador. Children are, in fact, leaving El Salvador, and there's gangs and violence there, too. But there's a new government of Salvador Sanchez-Cerén of the FMLN, of the very overt left in El Salvador that just came to power, and they have real political will to deal with this question. So we can't lump in the government of El Salvador with the governments of Honduras and military, and those Honduras and Guatemala. The other case to pay attention to is Nicaragua. And even The Economist magazine now says this, that Nicaragua has clean police. Nicaragua has community-based police. They're the outcome of the Sandinista revolution and post-revolution Sandinista governments. People trust the police, and they don't have cartels are not embedded. The gangs are not embedded in Nicaragua. They are the way they are in the so-called Northern Triangle countries. So it's also, you know, organizing works. I mean, things are different. There's political will and hope in El Salvador, even though things are very, very poor there. Nicaragua is equally poor, and people are not fleeing to the United States, and they do trust the police. So it's also important to look at models for social change, successful social change that we can see in Central America.
Dana Franks, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much, Bill. And don't forget, everybody, please contact your Congress member and or senator.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police.
This is the Old Bull Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and that was The Sound of the Police by KRS-One. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with historian Dana Frank of UC Santa Cruz about the fallout from the most recent U.S.-backed coup in Honduras and our continuing support for the Honduran police and military in the name of fighting a war on drugs. In Dana Frank's description of what's been happening in Honduras, as in the very notion of the war on drugs, we can hear a blurring of the categories of police and military. There's been much attention of late to what's described as the militarization of the police in the U.S. As Tamara K. Knopper and Mariam Kaba note in Jacobin, discussions about America's militarized police forces seem to have become suddenly semi-mainstream, appearing in media like The Economist and Business Insider. In the wake of the police killing of African-American teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the subsequent riots and protests, social media is littered with images of tear gas, tanks, and police in military gear with automatic weapons, all aimed at black people in the city. Earlier this summer, the ACLU released a report on the militarizing of U.S. policing, confirming the increasing and increasingly indiscriminate use of special weapons and tactics teams. Under a program started in 1990 and escalated after 2001, local law enforcement agencies have been getting surplus military equipment, everything from battering rams and flashbang grenades to helicopters and mine-resistant armored personnel carriers, tanks, basically, of which Clackamas County has two. Of course, once police forces have all this new equipment, they're eager to use it, and unsurprisingly, they tend to use it disproportionately on people of color. A recently released report on the extrajudicial killings of 313 black people by police, security guards, and vigilantes calculated that every 28 hours in 2012, someone employed or protected by the U.S. government killed a black man, woman, or child. The ACLU report is titled War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing, but Knopper and Kaba are wary of the notion that the war on terror has come home and of the connection some have been making between Ferguson and Gaza. They stress that, for blacks, the war on terror hasn't come home, it's always been here. Knopper and Kaba note that Julie Kohler Hausman, Radley Balko, and others have explained that the militarization of U.S. police can be traced back to the mid-1960s. For example, in 1968, urban police forces were able to buy new equipment and technologies thanks to funding from the newly passed Safe Streets Act. The social anxiety and fear engendered by the Vietnam War and by domestic urban rebellions led by black people provided license for the police to turn these new products on the marginalized populations of inner-city America. SWAT teams, batarams, and no-knock warrants all predate contemporary hyper-militarized police forces. Black people have been the overwhelming targets of these instruments of war. Yasmin Nair is similarly skeptical of the hashtag equation between Gaza and Ferguson, noting that easy analogies erase specificities and thus can make us less able to engage with and eventually end state brutality. But Nair also recognizes that there are some real material connections between the two. For instance, the Anti-Defamation League and related groups have sponsored trainings in Israel for U.S. police, including for police in St. Louis. The militarizing of policing is a global development, and Nair has important things to say about the complex and varied ways that racism and capitalism intertwine. Knopper and Kaba have important things to say about the difficulty American culture has in naming what black people experience in America and in empathizing with it in ways that are not narcissistic or voyeuristic on the part of whites. Knopper and Kaba point out that, quote, the problem with casting militarization as the problem is that the formulation suggests it is the excess against which we must rally. We must accept that the ordinary is fair for an extreme to be the problem. The policing of black people carried out through a variety of mechanisms and processes is purportedly warranted as long as it doesn't get too militarized and excessive. Attention is drawn to the spectacular event rather than to the point of origin or the mundane. Circulated are the spectacles, dead black bodies lying in the streets, or black teenager ambushed by several police officers in military gear, automatic weapons drawn. As Knopper and Kaba stress, in focusing on the excess, the overkill of state power, we miss the ordinary, as though without the overkill there could be the right amount of kill. But so insofar as the function of a police force is to enforce the interests of capitalist and white supremacist social order, the possibility that police might do their job with more subtlety is no real solution for people oppressed by those interests. At the same time, there really has been an increase in visible authoritarian force, and we can understand it as part of the current neoliberal response to the crisis of capitalism. Militarized policing means not only money-making opportunities for those who profit off weapons manufacture in private prisons, but also an escalating response to rising dissent. The job of the old mole is to persist in that dissent, despite its dangers, to make the difficult connections among the varied forms of capital and state power, and among the diversely positioned groups those powers oppress, to support and join with those who refuse servitude and resist injustice, to burrow on. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
This is what happens when you call the cops. Say what? This is what happens when you call the cops. Come on. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
I'm sick of people being victimized by criminal cops. Psychopathic predators terrorizing neighborhood blocks. Equipped with pepper spray, mace, cuffs, tasers, and glocks. They like serial killers acting out subliminal thoughts. Forget what you taught. These cops have got a license to kill. Witness intimidation means that they can use
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and that was Rob Hussle with Call the Cops, for which there is a very informative video. You can find a link to that video, as well as to the sources for my comments on policing and a link to Bill's interview with Dana Frank on Honduras, by visiting the audio page for this show in a couple of days on our KBOO webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And we'll share those links on Facebook as well, so please friend or follow us there too. Later this hour, Jan Hocken will be talking with Robert Adams and Chris Soaboto of Sisters of the Road Cafe. But first, Jan and Joe will be talking about the movie Omar.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I'm Jan Hocken, and we will be talking today about Omar, a film written and directed by Hani Abu Assad.
Omar is a story about its title character, played by Adam Bakri, and how he gets taken in by Israeli secret police and turned into a collaborator. Omar is a young baker in love with a teenager named Nadia, played by Lem Lubani, who lives on the other side of the wall along the West Bank, which Omar scales at his peril to pass love letters along to. He's also a member of a Palestinian resistance cell with two childhood friends, Tarek, played by Iyad Hurani, and Amjad, played by Samer Bishurat, and scales the wall to plan acts of resistance with them, too. One night they go out to the Kalandia checkpoint where Amjad shoots an Israeli soldier. The Israeli secret police eventually catch up with Omar and take him into custody. When in jail, he's tricked into a confession by a secret agent, played by Walid Zuatir, and is given a choice between becoming an informant and dying in prison. When he doesn't complete his mission, thinking he can work both sides, he's caught again by the secret police, who now threaten his girlfriend. Released a second time, Omar's struggle to remain loyal to his compatriots intensifies to a tragic end.
This film has been compared to Abu Assad's previous film, Paradise Now, which also is about resistance to Israeli occupation and the efforts of Palestinians to hold something together of their humanity as well as their capacity for resistance. With that film, the focus was on two men who prepare for a suicide attack in Israel. This film also is about military resistance, violence, but it has a much more kind of intimate tone to it and really focuses much more on how relationships, daily intimate relationships, are corrupted and overtaken by the conditions of the occupation.
Yeah, which is of, you know, paramount importance to, you know, actual lived conflicts, but it also resonates with the various ways in which we are experiencing the penetration of a surveillance state and an increasingly militarized government willing to do what it wants.
The film opens with Omar scaling the Kalandia Wall, the structure around the main checkpoint between the northern West Bank and Jerusalem. And this wall registers over and over the obstacles he encounters and his friends resisting the occupation. But I think it also, early on, introduces an element of hope because he does scale this wall and he makes a joke early on. How did you get here? And that's where they identify this Kalandia Wall. He said, well, I flew in. So there's a reference to his wiliness and his gracefulness. He's like a trapeze artist. So you have a sense of his confidence that he can kind of create a life with this young woman together under these impossible conditions, even as he's planning to carry out this revolutionary act.
Yeah, and there's a way that that opening scene with him darting through the corridors kind of sets up this tone of not exactly bureaucratic navigation, but a navigation of like a complex Baroque structure of choices and impossible outcomes.
Where he's blocked at every turn, but you see him throughout much of the film eluding the police. And he's quite resilient. You can see he's been tortured in jail, and yet he remains kind of clear-headed. There's a kind of innocence and a sensitivity to him that raises questions about whether he can hold up under the conditions of what a revolutionary has to endure, who is imprisoned and tortured and faced with terrible, impossible choices as he is, as the film unfolds.
And yet he's not a perfect hero. He gets tricked by a secret agent, quite actually cleverly, into saying something that the state agent said could be construed as a confession, which was used to kind of start to break his will about at least agreeing to be a collaborator.
Often there is this kind of stark counterposition of people who break under torture, people who do not have the strength of character commitment to withstand what they have to endure, both psychological torture and physical torture, and those who can endure all of that and who are the heroes of resistance. But this is much more about how strong people, where there's too much to bear here. And the binds he's put in are so difficult that it really isn't so much about physical torture as it is about emotional and psychological suffering. And part of that suffering centers on his own relationship with the secret agent, the Israeli agent, where initially all the power resides with this agent who has him trapped and cornered at every turn. But as the film unfolds, you have a sense of his own different ways in which resistance is expressed. As there's some intimacy that unfolds in moments between the two of them, there's, I think, a psychological dynamic between the two of them that, without giving away the ending of the film, I think becomes, I guess, a kind of love story between the interrogator and the interrogated, as well as the love story between him and his girlfriend.
I think we can look at it in terms of relationships like that, but I also think that the agent serves to kind of play with this idea that we're often forced to play with ourselves, that, you know, people with state power, people with, you know, awesome, monstrous power that they will sometimes use are also just real people. And sometimes this is used to seduce us into thinking that we should have compassion for them and be willing to not hurt them.
This is Jan Hawken and Joe Clement. We're talking today about the film Omar. Well, I think there was a story early on in the film that it kind of prefigures this, the seductions of power, not just the brute force of the state, but the seductiveness of power and how that seduction can work both ways. Amjad tells his companions early on about hearing about these anthropologists who trap monkeys by putting out sugar for them, and then the monkeys become so addicted to the sugar that when the anthropologists trap them by putting sugar out, the monkeys put their paws in and they will not let go of that sugar to escape, that it's the sugar rather than the trap itself that dooms them. And there is that way in which the Israeli agent becomes kind of seduced by Omar, and Omar kind of seduces him as well. There are little moments of intimate gestures, the way in which the agent keeps sucking on Tic Tacs and offers him Tic Tacs, you know, a little bit of sugar he resists, but this exchange between them becomes quite complicated as the film unfolds.
There is at least one scene where the agent takes this kind of personal call, apparently from his wife or his wife's mother, trying to get somewhere, and they need him to pick him up, and he's like, I'm on the West Bank, you know, I'm at work. And it's the way that Omar starts studying him in that moment reveals, you know, his way into him.
That scene also vividly dramatizes the asymmetry of their situation, where this agent is struggling with who's going to pick up his daughter, and Omar is struggling with the threat of death and not being able to marry his girlfriend. And the conditions are blocked at every turn for the two of them. And the relationship between these two young people in love was itself, I think, quite interesting in how it was drawn out in the film. Initially set up as a fairly traditional patriarchal situation where she seems to be very much under the supervision of her older brother and her father. But I think over the course of the film, she acquires much more agency. It's clear that she is very smart and struggles herself with moral choices. So she, as a protagonist, I think is drawn out in some very interesting ways in this film.
There's this one funny quip between them, I think, after he gets out of jail the first time, where they're talking and there was some question of his allegiance, but she basically says, you know, if they kept you, I would have, you know, learned to use a gun and come save you myself. And that, you know, steps out of this idea of women's role in that society simply being subjugation to men.
And even though the world around them collapses and invades every living space, including the space of their love for each other, there is still, I think, a real hopeful aspect of this film and their capacity for commitment, for kind of a certain kind of fidelity, even as people are compromised. It's been described by some as a paranoid film. I don't see this as a paranoid film. I think the reality of fear and betrayal are palpable, but in many ways it's a very hopeful film given the conditions under which the drama unfolds.
Though it really struggles to make that, you know, hope a very qualified one by the end, because they really bring home the message of how powerful the state is and what it means when a massive state that we have allowed to grow gets into our personal lives in the ways that the Israeli intelligence or secret police or whatever they are do.
We see him scaling that wall over and over with incredible agility, but midway or two-thirds way through the film, he can't do it. And an old man comes by in a cane, and Omar is kind of spiritually and physically weak. And the old man said, "It's okay, I'll help you over." And he props him up and he scales the wall. And I think that worked as a metaphor that there is a possibility for scaling the walls in the world, but you need something to support you and prop you up.
This has been Joe Clement and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking about a 2013 film called Omar, which you can find at the Multnomah County Library.
That was I'm Tired of Being Stepped On by KRS-One. And before that, we heard from Movie Moles Jan and Joe about Omar. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. And next up, Jan will be talking with Robert Adams and Chris Sobroto from the Sisters of the Road Cafe.
Welcome to KBOO, Chris and Robert.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, you're co-manager of the cafe, and Robert, you are a volunteer and board member. So let's start with the description of the cafe itself, in case people have just newly moved to Portland and don't know about the Sisters of the Road Cafe, which is hard to imagine, but possible. So maybe describe what the cafe does, and then Robert, we'll have you talk some about the role of volunteers.
Yeah, so Sisters is a nonprofit cafe in Old Town, and we've been in the same location since 1979, so we are actually celebrating our 35th anniversary on November 7th, and everybody's welcome, so come on down to the cafe to celebrate with us. From the beginning, we've had a pretty radical model of food justice, based on the belief that everybody has the right to dine with dignity. Most of the folks who come to the cafe, everybody's welcome, but a lot of our customers are people experiencing homelessness and poverty and don't necessarily have access to healthy, fresh meals. And so Sisters is an amazing place where people can access fresh food. A meal at Sisters is $1.50. That's been the price since the beginning. And people have the option of paying with cash with their SNAP benefits. And we're actually one of the only organizations that allows people to use their SNAP benefits for hot prepared food.
Do you want to say what the SNAP benefit is?
SNAP benefits are previously known as food stamps. Folks who need a little additional income to buy food can get these SNAP benefits. And for the most part, people can only use them to buy like vegetables and not hot prepared food. So for our community, people have limited ways to prepare food and to cook food. So it was really important that they could use these SNAP benefits that they deserved to feed themselves with fresh hot meals. So we did some work in the 80s to change legislation around that. The other way that people pay for a meal is through helping us in the cafe, through barter work. And that can be anything from busing tables, plating food, taking the food out to people, drinks, hosting the bathroom, reservation system. And for every half hour of work, we pay them credit, $3 of credit, and these punch cards that they can use to eat in the cafe or to share with friends.
So this explains some of the role of a volunteer, and most organizations do draw on and some rely heavily on volunteers. But as I understand it, Sisters of the Road has a different vision of the role of volunteers in many organizations. Robert, can you speak to that?
Well, the volunteers that come to Sisters are from every walks of life, not only regular community members who eat there. But we get, we get lawyers and secretaries and, I mean, just you name it. They come in and we have a volunteer orientation that we do every month, and anybody's welcome to come do that. But the basic thing about having the volunteers at Sisters is that it's for all aspects of Sisters. I mean, we come in early in the morning and help get this cafe set up, and we help do prep work in the kitchen. And, I mean, so it's a really big deal at Sisters, the volunteers. A lot of the work done in the cafe is done by the volunteers, and the people enjoy the work. And that's what's really amazing. They come back day after day. I mean, they're just, you know, you see people who come in on Wednesday and you know they're going to be there the next Wednesday. And
so it's a form of community.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, how are you doing this morning? Whoever the volunteer, I mean, everybody knows everybody by name. It's like a big family. You know, it's like being at home and cooking a big meal with the family and getting ready to have a big dinner with the family. So
many people associate contributions of food with something like the Blues Festival, where you bring a few cans of food for the food bank and cans of canned food is then distributed in some way to homeless people or people who are food insecure. And I often wonder where that can of tuna is going to go, and kind of imagine people opening that can by themselves some way. And I know often there's an issue around preparing that food, but and the difficulties of preparing food when you're homeless or in a situation where you don't have secure housing. But the restaurant has a different vision of food and the role of food in the lives of homeless people. Can you, Robert, say a little more about how this vision of food and sharing food, it's both the work of preparing but also the sharing of food and meals is part of the vision of Sisters Eating. Because it's not just about sustaining yourself with nutrition, but something social about eating.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you come into Sisters of the Road and have a meal, it's not like a regular cafe or restaurant where you go and sit down at one table and you're there at the table by yourself. You know, you might walk into Sisters today and sit with somebody you've never known, and you get the chance to talk to somebody you never talked to, and you find out their name. And it's just a big social structure and that's part of having a good meal. You know, if you I've been to restaurants where you sit down and have the meal by yourself, and if you're sitting there, you just feel, a lot of times you feel just lonely. You're just sitting there, you know. You want to eat, and you know you don't want anybody bothering you because you don't have that social structure around you. But as Sisters, it's like I said, it's like a big family. You get to know the person next to you and what you know they might want to tell you their problems, and you might want to tell them your problems, and you know. And so, I mean, it's more than just the food, you know, and it's about the people around you. And if you know, you get to care about the people around you. And there's a lot of times, you know, I'll be sitting there and I'll hear somebody say that they needed something or they had a bad day or, you know, and you just get to talk to them. And so it's just doing that can make a person's day go a lot better, you know. Yeah. So,
and you're also doing some field trips this summer, as I understand it, getting out of the cafe and extending the vision of the cafe into the farmer's market. Chris, can you say a little about the farmer market program that you've started?
Absolutely. The farmer's market program, Healthy Plate Project, was sort of an obvious next step for Sisters of the Road. You know, we have some amazing relationships with local farmers who bring us great fresh food. We're able to provide some amazing, healthy, nutritious meals in the cafe. But what happens when we're closed in the evenings and in the weekends? So what we did is we, New Seasons Market, put up the initial funding for this program. And how it works is that people can use the barter cards that they have earned, $3 for half an hour work, and go to 7 Portland farmers markets. And they can turn them in for $15 worth a day. So that's seven markets a week. That's quite an increase to their weekly food budget. And they're able to purchase anything except hot prepared foods, alcohol, and flowers. But I have folks who have bought plant starts and have started a huge, garden in their shared housing. People are pooling their money together and preparing really great meals to share. So we've been taking folks to the farmer's market, make sure, everybody feels comfortable there, introduce them to the system, walk around, talk to vendors, sample, and it's really spread. People have really enjoyed attending the markets and participating.
The farmer's markets as a progressive movement, not only in this country, around the world, is generally celebrated, but also sometimes criticized as serving a kind of a elite group of privileged people. There are certain assumptions we bring to food in terms of knowing how to prepare vegetables that look exotic or strange. I mean, food is deeply cultural, and the farmer's market often involves a certain cultural capital as well as money you bring to those places to shop. Robert, what's been your experience with being part of these field trips and how people navigate what can seem kind of alien in a way if you're not familiar with a lot of those foods?
Well, like Chris was saying, when you go to the farmers markets, and we go out on the field trips especially, you go around and talk to the vendors and different stuff, and a lot of them will tell you, you know, some of the things. And even
like how to use that odd root vegetable. Right. you have no idea what it is.
Yeah, and a good example is PSU actually does a little cooking thing that they show people what they can actually use some of these fruits and vegetables for. So, I mean, so you're not left in the dark as to what to do with them, you know. And you can prepare some amazing meals from the stuff that you get at the farmer's market. You know, I go over to a friend's house and I cook for him. And Saturday, I cooked a meal that was totally from the farmer's market. I mean, there was nothing. I didn't buy anything extra from the store. You know, you can buy meat. I bought lamb. I bought fresh carrots, mushrooms, onions. I mean, so you can get just everything you need at the farmer's market, and the food is a better quality, I believe, than what you can get in the stores. You know, I shop a lot of the organic farmers, you know, so I mean, and, you know, I always hit the Food Works stand first. They're partners with Sisters of the Road. So I always hit them first to see what they have that I can use to prepare a meal with, and then I shop from there. But I mean, you know, you it's wonderful when you get all these nutritious, delicious foods. I mean, this stuff, I had carrots, fresh carrots, that they tasted, I mean, they were crispier, they were all mushy, and so, I mean, it was really great. So I would encourage people to use more of the farmers markets, you know, so.
Well, that's quite an endorsement. And there's something called Food Works there that just, can you just explain what that is?
So Food Works is an organic farm out on Salbies Island. They teach teenagers from 14 to 21, I believe it is, how to farm organically. And they do it from preparing the ground all the way to selling the stuff at the farmers markets. So being that, and we go out there about three times a year and help them on the farm. So I always go to them first at the farmers markets to see what I can get.
That's good to know. Chris, tell us about where, in closing, where people can find out about Sisters of the Road Cafe, how they can support it, and learn about some fall events.
Absolutely. Definitely check out our website. We always have some great events. See what's on the calendar there. In September, we have a really exciting event, Dining with Dignity. So there's a whole list of local area restaurants who'll be donating a percent of proceeds to Sisters. So definitely get out there and eat. And the Portland Art Institute Culinary School will be doing a special event on the 16th. And we're really looking forward to that meal.
It's terrific. Jan Hawken talking today with Chris Broto and Robert Adams with Sisters of the Road Cafe. Keep up the good work and the good meals.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I do. Oh, your Constitution. Of all the evil, it will have to end.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You just heard Nina Simone singing Revolution. Before that, Jan Hawken talking with Robert Adams and Chris Sobroto of the Sisters of the Road Cafe. Thanks to them and to Jan and Joe for their discussion of Omar, to Joe for also engineering. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest Dana Frank. I'm Fran Michelle. You can find the audio of this show as well as illuminating and entertaining links on our KBOO webpage in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
And you have it tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up is Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we will broadcast part two of a forum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how this secretive free trade agreement will impact local efforts to ban GMOs, recorded on June 19th in Portland. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Jamie Kaufman about the chronic cough enigma. And at 11:30 on Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall leads a conversation with Sarah Finger McDonald of the Oregon Chapter, Leader for Moms Demand Action. This group is dedicated to promoting health and safety and measures that could help to keep children safe from violence. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.